IFRS 9. So, Alfon, you're going to take the lead on this one, and I think we've got Liz Figge on the phone in case we need to quiz her on something, if she wants to check it. I'm going to hand over to you.
Okay, thank you.
Agenda paper 3.
Yes. Thank you. So in this paper, we discussed the feedback on the committee's tentative agenda decision that addressed the request about the consequential amendment that IFRS 9 made to paragraph 82A of IS 1. That consequential amendment requires an entity to present separately in the profit or loss section of the statement of comprehensive income or in the statement of profit or loss interest revenue calculated using the effective interest method. In its tentative agenda decision, the committee concluded that this new presentation requirement applies only to those financial assets that are subsequently measured at amortized cost or fair value through OCI, subject to any effect of a qualifying aging relationship, applying the age accounting requirements in IFRS 9 or IS 39. The committee also noted that it did not consider any other presentation requirements in IS 1, or broader matters related to the presentation of interest amounts in the statement of comprehensive income. The committee received 7 comment letters. 3 respondents agreed with the committee's technical analysis and tentative conclusion. In contrast, 4 respondents either expressed comments, concerns on or disagreed with particular aspects of the analysis and conclusion. There were 5 areas that elicited comments. 2 respondents commented on the scope of the tentative agenda decision. As described in paragraph 13 and 14 of the agenda paper, those respondents said that the committee addressed a question that was different from the one submitted. Our analysis of those comments is set out in paragraph 15 to 18 of the agenda paper. We would like to highlight that the committee intentionally decided to address only the consequential amendment that IFRS 9 made to IS 1. This is because the submission focused on that change. The committee did not consider any matters related to the presentation of other interest amounts in the statement of comprehensive income because the consequential amendment did not affect those broader matters. We continue to think this approach is appropriate because it addresses in a timely manner any uncertainty in practice about the scope of the new presentation requirement. In addition, we note that respondents did not provide any new information beyond that considered by the committee when reaching its tentative agenda decision. 3 respondents also commented on the committee's conclusion that the requirement in paragraph 82A of IS 1 applies only to assets that are subsequently measured at amortized cost or fair value through OCI. We analyzed those comments in paragraph 23 to 28 of the agenda paper. We continue to agree with the committee's conclusion and note that the committee considered many of the points raised by respondents when reaching its tentative agenda decision. 3 respondents also questioned whether the committee's tentative agenda decision conflicts with the requirement in paragraph 20B of IFRS 7. As explained in paragraph 32 to 35 of the agenda paper, we think the requirements in paragraph 82A of IS 1 and paragraph 20B of IFRS 7 are complementary. Specifically, IFRS 7 requires further disaggregation of the interest revenue amount required by IS 1. 3 respondents also questioned whether the new presentation requirement would provide relevant information, and 1 respondent said the new requirement would result in significant additional cost for preparers. As explained in paragraph 39 to 41 of the agenda paper, we think the board fully considered the relevance of the information provided during its deliberation on IFRS 9. In this situation, we think the role of the Interpretations Committee is not to reconsider the relevance of the information provided. In addition, as explained in paragraph 42 of the agenda paper, we are unconvinced that the application of the new requirement would result in significant additional costs. Finally, as described in paragraph 44 and 45 of the agenda paper, two respondents commented on particular wording in the tentative agenda decision. For the reasons set out in paragraph 46 to 49 of the paper, we recommend the committee does not make any drafting changes in response to those comments. Having considered all the comments received, we recommend that the committee finalize the tentative agenda decision as published in the November 2017 IFRIC update. I will now ask whether you agree with this recommendation.
Thank you. Bertrand?
It was three of the four negative comment letters came from France.
Comment first. So maybe to mention, if you allow me, Patrina and Sue, we organized a call between the FBF and the ANC and the staff, ISB and Interpretations Committee. I think there were interesting exchanges at that time, maybe a bit more profound than just the comment letters and the analysis of the comment letters. From what I've understood from those exchanges, I would say that the mere question that emerged from French banks were on the requirements, the basic requirements of 82A, and the questioning of these requirements, and first and second, the second comment was more on where to present the information, whether it is on the face of the P&L statements or in the notes to the financial statements. And that was basically their comments on the interaction between 82A, IS1 82A on one hand, and IFRS 7 on the other. So I think basically, and it will probably revert back to the discussions we had earlier today on IFRS 15. I don't see how we can, as an interpretations committee group, I don't see how we can do anything else than just interpreting what is worded in 82A. I think that the French banks have that have also that in mind. It was stated to them rather clearly, but I think at the same time there was a proposal. Only if you want to comment on that, Patrina. But there was a or Elisabeth, if she wants to comment on that, as she's on the phone. There was a proposal made to revert some of the comments and proposals made by the FBF, notably. To the ISB, and probably, for sure, we can't change, or let's put it that way, as personally, as an Interpretations Committee member, I don't see how we can change the agenda decision to address the questions or the concerns of the French banks, but at the same time, I think to acknowledge the fact that we have heard their questions by stating effectively somewhere in the IFRIC update that there will be a reference made to the ISB at some point in time, and that this issue might eventually then give rise to additional exchanges in the future, and notably maybe within the PRR review of IFRS 9 might possibly be useful for those constituents. Sorry to have you.
So maybe I'll just add, because Bertrand, you mentioned it, and just to explain to everyone that after posting the paper and the paper was final, as Bertrand said, we had a call with some of the respondents where they just explained a bit more what they had in their comment letter. I think the suggestion that you're referring to, Bertrand, was, I think, a suggestion on that call in the context of board's ongoing projects, in a sense, whether that possibly was the primary financial statement project or possible future PI, or that they were sort of, at least they were suggesting possibly that the board might consider the presentation of interest in the statement of profit or loss for financial institutions. And if I understood correctly, Bertrand, then that was potentially the suggestion they were interested in is passing that information to the board as part of what the board might consider as part of, as I say, either maybe primary financial statements or something else.
Yeah, well, primary financial statements might be used.
Which is, I think, a valid suggestion. So our primary financial statements project so far has really been focused on the sort of non-FI sphere, if you like, but we're going to circle back to the FI sphere. And so as part of that, we could have a look at the presentation of net interest margin, I think, not even just net interest, not even just interest revenue. So we could have a look at it there. So I think that's a good suggestion and one that the staff intend to follow up on. I think, though, in the context of IS1, as you say, the board does specifically think about the relationship between the classifications on the balance sheet and this line item. So I think that's a different discussion, but there's no reason why we can't look at it more holistically. And I think the macro project also is potentially another place where it could be relevant.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And, I mean, maybe then that obviously the board members around this table now has heard that, but if it's helpful, when we, you know, that you know, after every committee meeting, we at a public board meeting, we report back to the board and all of the committee's discussions, and we could certainly relay that to the board at that meeting so that all board members hear that comment.
So agree with the staff analysis and decision, and just a couple of comments. I think it would be helpful if we could make a positive statement about presenting the interest amounts in distinct comprehensive income, but I understand that we may not wish to do that. And then just to echo Bertrand's comment, I think we would welcome analysis of net interest margin as well, and some guidance from the board on that, and the components of it, how it develops over time, how it will develop in the future, and interaction with macro hedging. I think that would be very welcome for the financial sector.
Thank you. Reinhardt?
I guess I'll round out the comment letters that didn't support the agenda decision. And I'll be consistent. And really where I guess my biggest concern comes about is the fact that we as a committee didn't address the question that was raised by the organization that provided the comment or the question. And the way I see this, the background to this is that, as we know, and I think as the original agenda paper highlighted, there's diversity in practice in terms of what is shown in interest income, and including showing an interest income among financial institutions, the interest component of trading derivatives. And so I think there was the view of some that this statement in IS1 combined with the statements in IFRS 9 about the fact that interest or the coupon on a derivative is not interest income, that the combination of that suggested that it would be no longer possible to show interest on trading derivatives in the net, in the interest income line, and therefore reduce the diversity in practice that exists. And so my concern is that by specifically addressing only this issue and saying that all that should be included in this line item under paragraph 82A is interest on assets for which the amortized cost method is used, but does not address other presentation matters, it will potentially, well, the diversity, I think, will continue and potentially exacerbate the diversity. And so that is really my concern, is I think there was, as they say, in summary, the view of some that these requirements, the new requirement IS1, paragraph 82A, combined with some of the discussion of IFRS 9 in totality, would suggest a different presentation of trading derivatives, perhaps that had been accepted by some in practice, and therefore reducing diversity. So that's my overall concern with respect to the agenda decision. And then, you know, I think the other comment I've made before and is consistent with some comment letters is the fact that although I absolutely agree the effective interest method is an inherent component of the amortized cost method, I don't think the reverse holds necessarily true. That may be the board's intent, but I don't think that's necessarily clear from the standard itself. And so I wouldn't preclude the use of the amortized cost method for other instruments. But as I say, those are my personal views. My biggest concern is the overall one I mentioned before.
Maybe if I could just comment on that overall one, if I may just. You're right that the question that the agenda decision proposes to answer is a much more modest question than the one that came in to us. And I think we did that intentionally when we discussed it last time and in the draft. And it's modest in the sense that it doesn't really preclude too much. It's quite generous in a sense because all it's doing is being very specific about what one particular line item must contain and not really opining on the rest. I think it does help a little bit in the on your trading derivative point because it means at least you in that pure line item you can't have the trading derivative coupons in there and call them interest. So at least say we've got one pure line item, but it doesn't go on further. But I think that was conscious for two reasons. One, the fact that 82A was the specific and consequential amendment that came from 9, so it was a sort of neat way to scope it. But I also think it comes back to the point that Mary made a little bit earlier on about being careful with these new standards like 9 and 15 to sort of be helpful and not disruptive, because I think for us to opine on what 82A can contain is much less burdensome for people because, and much less of a potential surprise because they already have to have the information for the IFRS 7 disclosure. So there's a change if they haven't intended to present it separately, but at least they have the information. Whereas if we commented now on the treatment of trading derivatives more generally, I think that could have a potential massive effect on people's implementation of IFRS 9. So I think that sort of disruptive consideration for me partly comes into my assessment. Tony?
So I agree with the staff's analysis. I'm happy to proceed with the agenda decision. My sense is that I think for the reasons explained that the effective interest method is something that drives off assets that are measured at amortized cost and assets that are measured at fair value through profit or loss. You may possibly identify a component that you may say is similar to something calculated using the effective interest method, but I think what is in IAS 1 is clear that the line item required by 5 paragraphs is interest revenue that is calculated in that way. So I support the agenda decision. I think once you get beyond that in IAS 1, IAS 1 is quite a broad church. I think paragraph 85 of IAS 1 talks about additional line items and headings and so forth if that's relevant to explaining performance. And my sense is that gives people the flexibility to present the information that they believe is helpful to understanding performance. And if it is helpful to separate out those items, then I think that flexibility exists within IAS 1. I understand that might, as Ryan Hunt says, it might result in some diversity, but I think paragraph 85 of IAS 1 is likely to result in diversity anyway because of different judgments about what's relevant in the context of a particular set of financial statements. So overall, I'm comfortable with the staff decision and that we finalise it as it's drafted.
Thank you. Bob?
Very similar to Tony, I'm prepared to move ahead, proceed to finalise the agenda decision. I agree with the comments you just made, Sue, that we didn't answer all the questions that were submitted, but I don't think we have the tools to be able to do so. I think all we can do is tell people, what does 82A, that line, specific line item, what is included in that, and then 85 is very broad and doesn't preclude other line items, doesn't preclude necessarily having other things that are similar to interest revenue and that are calculated using a method that is very similar to the effective interest method. But I don't think we have enough here that we can provide guidance, nor do I think it's a game we want to get into, because then we're going to get all types of questions on different line items in the performance statement. And I'd rather leave that for the board.
Thank you.
All right. I saw similar concerns from other banks, other than French banks, and before I came here. And I think because the banks may have different types of interest earned, or here, I remember we intentionally leave it only to those things we would like to say. Leave all the other line items open for other discussions. So I think during our discussion before I came here, they may create some other line items, may not be named as interest income or revenue or interest earned or even other interests to show whatever calculated under other methods. So that may be the consequences. But here, because we cannot answer all the other line items yet, so we leave all these agenda decisions very narrowly defined. So I agree with the staff analysis and the outcome.
Thanks, John.
I support finalization of the agenda decision, although I do think it is a bit unfortunate that it's so narrow, because I do think that it's, I've always struggled with the taking interest revenue out of a fair value movement and calling it interest revenue. And I suspect that number not very often is calculated the way you would calculate an effective interest method, because you've got issues like transaction costs, which have been expensed because the instruments had fair value, which are not in the measurement, et cetera. So that's probably a contractual cash flow number rather than an effective interest number. So I would have preferred to tackle the issue much more holistically and dealt with it, but I understand why the committee, it's probably a job too far for the committee. But I support finalising the agenda decision. I think it's pretty clear when the board made the amendment to paragraph 82A, what it meant to be included in that line item. So I support finalisation.
Bruce?
Thanks, Sue. I'm a bit mixed on this one, and I'll tell you why. I was initially clearly in the camp of supporting it all the way, but then I kind of looked at the comment letters that the KPMG and others have written, and I guess I thought to myself, if I rewrote that part of the standard right now, would I make a conscious effort to make it a lot clearer what I meant? And I thought I probably would, because to be very honest with you, I can see where we get to, and I like the answer. So what I'm saying is, if you ask me support, I can see where we get to on the answer. The problem is, do I think that it's precluding the other instruments? So I think if I've got something that's a fair value through P&L, a non-derivative instrument, and for whatever reason it's got in there, do I think there's enough in there to preclude it? I'm not convinced that I think there's enough in the wording there, in my mind, that would stop you from being able to do it. So I've done a bit of a 180 on that. I actually think that I would have probably gone the other way, support more the KPMG view, and said I'm not convinced that I think it precludes you from doing that. I prefer the answer we're getting to, but I'm saying on the wording, I don't think I get there. Just another thing to point out that was interesting when I spoke to a number of people, the feedback on the perceived conflict between 82A and 20B and IFRS 7, almost everybody I spoke to about that saw that as a conflict. I didn't either when I initially read it, but a lot of them were kind of saying, well, which one is it? Do we do it or not? So what I was going to say is I'm not convinced that's something we should fix now. My comment was going to be it could be something interesting that if the ISB does decide to look at some sort of minor improvements or something around either IFRS 7 or IS1 at some point in the future, I think it's something that could do with a bit of clarity, but I don't think it's an urgent issue that I'd rush it onto an agenda right now. But just interesting that a number of people I spoke to read that as a little bit inconsistent.
Okay, thanks. Young Sue?
Yeah, first I want to say I agree with the staff analysis and conclusion. You know, we cannot expand the scope. But what we have to do is to scope in and think about only the standard that is given, and IFRS 9, so I understand that. But I also want to point out that presentation of the interest revenue and expenses of the fair value P&L separate from the revenue section of the income statement is a very, very important issue in the practice also. I want to say a few things. The first one is that revenue section is the main section, main revenue of the financial institutions. So whether to include interest revenue after those kind of fair value P&L into the revenue section is a very important part of the reporting of the financial institution. The second one is that, you know, before I come to the meeting, I talked with the several people in the financial institution, but their practice was so different. Some of them include the interest into the financial, I mean, into the revenue section. Some of them just posted into the note. So there's a big diversity. The third one was that, you know, third one that I want to say is that, you know, when I talk with them, they point out that no matter what decision we make in the future by the board, the cost of change the system is going to be big because they have to change the system based on the decision of the board. So that, you know, preferably, you know, as Bruce said, I want the committee says something about that issue, but that is not what we can do. Board has to do something in the future, but when the board has to do something in the future, they have to think about all these things, you know, importance, diversity, and the cost.
And just to confirm that, the staff have done some analysis on the different approaches people take to what they include in their net interest margin, and their findings are consistent with what you just said. It's something that we've already had an initial discussion with our user advisory group, the Capital Markets Advisory Committee, about, so we know that it is a sort of an important issue, so it's on the radar. But as you correctly point out, it's a very big deal for the banks, which is also why I think in the baby steps in the interim are probably more realistic. Sandy.
I guess I'm curious as to why it would be more expensive if it's already disclosed in the notes. That's confusing to me. If it's already segregated, why would it cost more to move it from one place to the other? Maybe I'm just not understanding, but I don't think I'm not understanding. It seems like this issue was discussed when IFRS 9 was created, and a mixed measurement model was chosen. Wasn't something we at CFA Institute liked, but it was something that was chosen. And with that came different presentation on the income statements that's necessary to reflect the difference in yield you're presuming occurs with how you've classified things on the balance sheet. I mean, we'd actually like the amortized cost to be different than the fair value through AOCI, because we'd like to calculate the yield on each specific class of assets. But to include in there items related to other fair value through P&L belies the notion of the classification that was chosen on the balance sheet, because of the fact that you've chosen that that's a total return type of instruments. So I agree with the staff conclusion. I'm confused why this is coming up now, because to me it seems like it was something that was really discussed through IFRS 9, at least I felt it was, whether we liked where it came out or not. But I agree with what Tony said. There's a choice. You can choose to break down and do further disaggregation. I don't seem that that's prohibited. It may be disliked, but it's not prohibited from the way I read it. So I'm kind of puzzled by the question, actually. But I think investors would even like more disaggregation. So if this pushes that, so be it.
Thanks, Sandy. Just on the cost point, and just to my understanding of the views of those who have raised the cost point, I think they were very fair. They did acknowledge the fact that they already needed the information for disclosure purposes. My understanding was that they were making the point that they'd already set up from a systems perspective what the line items were that would be captured in P&L. I'm looking at Bertrand to make sure I don't misspeak. That would be captured for presentation in P&L. The system hadn't been built to elevate that separate item, so the cost is related to that part of the system.
So that, but that, relates, it relates above all, it relates above all to the two initial questions I've raised, actually. So, and the net margin presentation.
As a controller of a financial institution, that doesn't seem impossible. I was a controller of a financial institution at one time. That doesn't seem impossible to reclassify it in the P&L.
It's not what they're saying. I'm not sure it's not what they are saying. What they are saying is that they are doing the disaggregation in the notes already.
Yep.
So they are providing the information. what they would see is in the P&L presenting maybe something more holistically referring to the net margin notion, actually. So presenting both interest revenue and interest expense.
I think it's and it is a change from the way the system was set up.
Yeah.
And it's not a change they really see the benefit of, I think, which is the message.
But that was more the overall question I was referring to. As
but,
a first comment.
But they do acknowledge they've collected the information. Mm. Andrew?
On the overall positioning of the agenda decision, I would support the focus on 82A and let 85 deal with the wider issues that we really don't want to go near and prod at this point. I think when I looked at the paper initially, like one or two others, I thought, well, I can go with that agenda decision, but then just thinking about it, I wondered whether we could really preclude one or two other items coming in here. And what I was thinking of in particular was an instrument that has contractual cash flows which are SPPI compliant, but an entity chooses to measure at fair value through profit or loss in order to eliminate or reduce a measurement mismatch. But it's still calculating interest income on an EIR basis. And I was doubtful that we could say to that entity, you can't put that EIR interest income into 82A. So I was a little bit troubled by that. Thinking more widely, would you go further than that and say on any instrument that's there, you could take out EIR interest element? I think that would probably go too far because I think that would drift you towards separating out embedded derivatives by the back door. And I don't think that's really what this was designed to do. So I think it would be quite a narrow group, but I'm not sure we can preclude that. On the question of IFRS 7 paragraph 20B and IS 182A, I don't think there's an inconsistency, even if you did have that small extra population. You've just got something else to put in there to reconcile yourself back.
Matt?
Yeah. I guess based on the submitted issue, it is a clear and logical solution of 82A. With regard to the issue, to explain a little bit more about interest income, interest expense, for sure. It is already in the note. It could be even, the banks could even do more in the notes if they really like and if they believe it is important for their steering. And that would also increase the validity, so to say, or the importance of the notes to have a look in the notes. With that, I guess we can go for that, non-agenda decision, so to say. Could one do more? Yes, for sure. But if that then would be the committee, I believe not.
Thank you, Martin. Sandy?
I guess I, as an aside, I don't think that investors perceive the presentation in the notes, whether you believe it or not, as important as the presentation on the income statement. So I don't view them as being the same. And I think that because we've chosen this classification on the balance sheet and the income statement, that I think that it belongs there so that people can see that comparison rather readily rather than to have to go dig for it.
Okay.